Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are, and I mean it. I really, really mean it. Those are not just catchphrases. You are a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to Jerusalem, to a beautiful day. I drove out of my house today. See, now today, when I live in Efrat now, right? So I'm an Efratian. I just moved there about 10 days ago. In my street, which is called Shivat Zion, and I thank the Lord for putting me on Shivat Zion Street, because it's like, thank you, God, for putting me on my life mission street, and which means the return to Zion. There are nice days where right from my house you could see the Temple Mount itself. Today was just one of those days. It rained at night. Perfectly beautiful, clear day today in Jerusalem. And everything just looked beautiful. Yet on the lower world, there was a lot of intensity. My parking here next to the Pardes Institute was, shall we say, I won't be surprised if there's either a break-in, a dent, or a ticket, or a tow-away when I get back to my car after this. So that's annoying, but it's all worth it because I get to see Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
That's real self-sacrifice. Hi, Yishai.
Well, it is the Torah portion of self-sacrifice, isn't
it? Or sacrificing someone else, as the case may be.
Well, it's really, right, when you're sacrificing your own son, you're pretty much sacrificing yourself and you're sacrificing...
Tell it to the kid.
Right.
we get Avram's perspective on this one.
This is going to hurt me.
Doesn't talk about it.
More than it's going to hurt you, son.
At least in the long run.
We're going to talk about the Akedah. I used to say they have Al-Qaeda, we have the Akedah, okay?
Ooh.
We'll talk about the Akedah.
Al-Qaeda is so 1990s.
Yeah, they are, aren't they?
Or 2000, whatever.
They are. They're not the real jihad these days.
No.
Bunch of sissies anyway. They were just like into
blowing up large buildings.
Right. They weren't into like
driving pickup trucks into crowds of people.
Right, right. Oh man, first thing this morning, like early in the morning, I looked at the thing and it's just like we stand with it was an anti-Israel jihadist guy tweeted, like, I hope my friends in New York aren't hurt. This guy's such a master snake. He's a snake mastered, man. Mm. He's a king cobra, this guy. Such a snake. His name is Isa Amru. He is the worst, snakiest snake of all time. My hashtag for him is fake human rights. This guy all day long uses fake human rights. Anyway, whatever. So, yeah, there's been a terror incident in New York. Although I saw that there's some debate whether it was a terror incident. Yes, the guy's got a long beard and he's a Muslim. Yes, he yelled Allahu Akbar.
And left notes proclaiming loyalty to ISIS on his dashboard.
But that could really be a work.
Coincidence.
Or a work disenchantment. What's it called when you're like dissatisfied with work?
Postal?
Postal, yeah. Anyway, that was that. Listen, Rabbi Mike, before we get to Parshat Vayera, I just want to talk for 1 second with you. Oh, we're on the Land of Israel Network, landofisrael.com. Good friends Ari and Jeremy doing great work. Thank you so much for hosting us here at this wonderful network. It's true that I've hosted you in the previous two networks that I ran, and now you're hosting me, but that's life. It's a wheel.
It goes around, comes around.
Yeah, you just got to hang on to the, as my friend Jeremy Sultan once said to me, he said, politics is like a steering wheel, and you just have to hold on. When they cut off your hands, grab it with your teeth. That's what he said. I'll never forget that imagery.
That kind of characterizes our prime minister.
That's right. Although, and yet his hands are whole somehow. God bless him. So the Land of Israel Network, we also have a lot of great sponsors, our good friends at the Janglo Network, the Janglo, janglo.net informational superhighway of what's happening here in Israel. We can't navigate Israel without it. Our good friends at Jay Brick making Jewish Lego pieces for your office so that you could, you know, play with something while thinking about those big dreams that you have about moving to the Land of Israel and building the temple. So go to jbrick.com, get yourself a nice little Jewish Lego setter for your kid. And our good friends at Hebron Fund, we have a humongous, unbelievable Shabbat coming up, folks. Shabbat Chai Sarah. There's a VIP thing that you could get through the Hebron Fund. You will fly in for the weekend. You'll come to Hebron and be part of it. It's going to supercharge you for the rest of the year. I could say with full confidence, there's like two Shabbats during the year, two dates during the year. If you get part of it, you fly in for that, you're going to be supercharged for the rest of the year. Obviously, the three, you know, big pilgrimage holidays. But other than those, Chai Sarah and of course Lag BaOmer, you come into those to Eretz Yisrael, you're gonna be like it's gonna juice you for the rest of the year. Anybody else, Rabbi Mike? Who else?
Other sponsors, Tchelet.
The Tchelet organization. I was just checking if you remembered. That's right, Tchelet.
Flying the colors.
That's right, flying the blue, the blue color, the blue string. True blue Jews, you said, Rabbi Mike. And I'm very proud to have the Nike contract with the good folks at Tchelet. I live it. I breathe it. I see Rabbi Mike is wearing it.
And sporting it.
Can I tell you something? You're like such... Have you felt... Honestly, no, seriously, with no joke. Have you felt a change since you put on Tchelet as a... You daven the Shema. I know you're...
I do you're that, into, yes.
You're into, but you're into prayer as a thing. When you look down at your tzitzit when it says a kanaf p'tir tchelet, have you felt
yeah,
it?
For sure. It's a much more visceral experience.
Yeah. It really is. It really is. Also, I want to say another, not exactly sponsor, but related part of the show is your show, which is called The Jewish Story. And I happened to listen to it last week. I try to catch it every week. But this past week was particularly interesting to me because I am personally very fascinated with the period of the 1550s and with the confluence of these great people that all came to Tzfat.
The Golden Age Tzfat.
Right. And you did a show about Rav Yosef Karo.
Mm-hmm.
I knew most of the facts, but there were a few things that I didn't know. For example, you talked about how the Shulchan Aruch was actually a kind of cliff notes.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote it at the end of his life, and there are many scholars who look and say that he never intended it to be definitive, but rather as a study guide, so to speak, for his real work, which was the Beit Yosef.
The Beit Yosef. I didn't know that part, so that was really cool. And I'm really much looking forward to this week's show, which is going to be about the Arizal.
Yes, the more mystic side of what was happening in Tzfat.
Right, but you also did point out the Rav Yosef Karo, who is known as the Mechaber, the great, what do we have to call Mechaber in English? The great author. The great
author, sure.
He's just called the author. You gotta yes. love Judaism. You gotta love Judaism that you get these titles. Some people are called, like, there's only a few people called Rebbe. You know, Rebbe, that's, you know, Rabbi Nasi, right? Rebbe's Rebbe.
Yep.
And then you have, you know, the Rebbe. That's the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Right. You know who the Rebbe is, right? And then you have all these different titles. Like, and some people have no title, like Hillel. Like, that's
Everybody
it.
Everybody knows.
That's him. I don't know. There's all these great names you get in the... Or people named after great books.
Well, that's there's a shift, actually, in the Mechaber. It's really when that shift begins. Before him, it's people have titles like the Rambam, the Ramban, the Rashba. People, the Rishonim, the early medieval authorities, didn't get the name of their books. It's the Achronim who become, oh, he's the Shulchan Aruch, he's the, you know, the Nefesh Chaim, he's the
Sfas Emes.
The Sfas Emes, Mishneh Berurah.
Ah, beautiful stuff. It's such a... when you do your show, you really get to feel like you're shaking these people's hands. To me... The reason I'm so fascinated by that particular segment that you're covering right now, first thing you pointed out in your show that it's a great transition of time on many levels, including, you know, between Rishonim and Achronim, and also the issue of modernity or early modernity and the printing press, that whole business and that big change. But to me, I feel very strong about this. This is the beginnings of Zionism. Of I'm talking about this. Third return to Zion. In my mind, did you ever see that movie, Pirates of the Caribbean?
Sure, a long time ago.
Okay, nothing to talk about here. But there's this part where the coin, this kind of whatever, this treasured coin, mm-hmm. falls into the water, and it sends out like a ping. It sends out a ping, and you see this like wave reverberates to the horizon.
Yeah,
and vaguely. You mentioned that you said something. You said it right at the very end of your show, The Jewish Story, on this network. You said the Arizal's. He sent some kind of shockwave, some kind of reverberation through time.
Yes.
And I really feel that there was a ping that went out to the world. And it was the confluence of these many good people, but especially the Arizal and Rav Yosef Karo together at the same time in Tzfat, under the Turkish mandate, under the Turkish sovereignty of the land of Israel. And it just sent out a signal that said, come home. We're in the time of ingathering.
I mean, it's an amazing thing. I don't know how far you want to go with it, but there's a very important shift that happens in the person, the Arizal. You know, Arnold Toynbee, great 20th century British historian.
Not a big fan of the Jews.
Not a big fan of the Jews, nor did he understand us, because in his masterful study, it's called The Study of History, he calls us a fossilized people. Because Toynbee, one of his most important observations is he said a civilization can actually already have crossed from rising to falling, even though it continues to grow. Americans, by the way, listen up, right? Because the difference becomes, in his mind, whether you worship your ancestors or your pioneers. So for most of our history, not most of the last 2,000 years, we've been looking backwards. And the Arizal represents that moment where he returns his own divine experience to a central legitimate source of authority, and is that turning point we're allowed to, where we're able even to turn our eyes forward. And if you think about what the Zionists did in a brutal fashion, was they cut off the past. And they said, we're done with that. We're moving forward. And suddenly you have a culture, a state, an empire, if you will, the Fifth Kingdom, as some like to call it.
Why fifth?
Because there are four kingdoms in the vision of Daniel.
Oh, yeah.
And
You mean empires that we kind of...
No, but we are meant to, because the Fifth Kingdom will last forever in the vision of Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's a longer discussion we can have in another time. But my point is
But certainly the Third Commonwealth.
Third Commonwealth of Am Yisrael, but the Fifth Kingdom of the world.
Right.
Right, the Arizal represents that moment of transition from backward looking to looking God in the face, as it were, in the present, which opens up the future. And that's really the power in my mind of what happened in Spot. And it was really only possible together with the Mechaber, together with someone who did all that work to bring the past into a solid foundation on which he could build. So that ping that you're hearing, which we live in today, we really live in today, because I agree with you 100%. That it was the beginning of the return at that point, was his opening up the possibility that our experience of God in the world today could be a legitimate source of guidance for where we're trying to go moving forward.
If you agree with that rubric, you might agree with the next step, which I think is a bit of a jump. Really, the Jewish people were actually exiled around the year 500 here in the land of Israel, is when really, like, because the Jews, remember, after the destruction of the temple, are still around. The mission is completed afterwards. They move north, but they're still around. But basically, I started thinking to myself, the exile really lasted about 1,000 years. The true core exiled.
I'd put it a little earlier than 500, but we can debate that later.
Okay, but it's not 2,000 years of exile.
Right, it's a nice number for us, but you are correct.
Yeah. Anyway, the Arizal, and we're definitely living in this time where the Arizal's energy and his great students that come after him, the Baal Shem Tov, the Gra, the Gaon Mevilna, and the Or Chaim HaKadosh, they all have two things in common: the study of the Kabbalah and the return to Zion.
And Kabbalah means received. Right. They have what they've received from the past, and the return to Zion is a vision of where they're trying to head.
Mm-hmm.
And their ability to embody that in the present is what made them such powerful, charismatic leaders.
I want to say hi to two folks that listen all the time. First thing, one of my great rabbis who taught me so much Torah, and I continue to learn Torah from him, is Rabbi Aaron Ziegler. Do you know Rabbi Ziegler by any chance?
I do not.
He gives smicha. He's a fantastic teacher. Also lectures a lot at the OU and over the holidays, and has a fantastic kolel achim, and he gives smicha, and he's a fantastic teacher. And he's a devout listener to the show.
Great.
He writes me an email every week, and I learned so much from him. Got my smicha from him, and I really appreciate him so much, Aaron Ziegler. Rabbi Aaron Ziegler is fantastic here in Yerushalayim, made Aliyah, of course. So God bless him. And I also want to say hi to a good friend of mine, Jake Bennett, out in Arizona, who listens to the show. And there's a lot of great Arizona folks. Jake is one of them. I didn't know that he listens to the show when we were talking this week. He told me that he listens every week, so I want to say hi to those two fabulous people who are doing great work. Jake is fighting for Israel on so many different levels. And people like him who are not here are sometimes just emissaries of God to be fighting for Israel wherever they are.
Amen.
Anyway, I want to say you're doing a great job in your show, and I'm really looking forward to this week's installment. To me, it's very important to understand this period, because I also think that it leads to the first Aliyot, and the first Aliyot are really religious Aliyot. The immigration to the land of Israel, and it's not called the first Aliyah.
No, but
they called it the Yeshuv HaYashan.
No, but there's no question that it was God that called us back before sort of European romantic nationalism fired up in the masses.
Right.
I do want to make an invitation to people to go to my Facebook page. I'm looking for folks to help me make history. Right, the time and the effort, it always involves money. So if you want to be a patron, you can go to my Facebook page, Rob Mike at Facebook, and you can see right at the top of the list there a very easy button to push for patreon.com.
Absolutely, that's great. And in general, folks, pony up, be part of the story. Your money is not just your money. I was sitting with somebody the other day. Who was I sitting with? And I had to explain to him that, like, money is not dirty. Money's a good thing.
with the tool for doing in the world. So the question is, what type of person are you?
Right, but right? But some people who are raised in a more literary and humanistic fashion, not in the business world, they think of money as something like...
Sorted,
right. And I'm just like, no, dude, no, not at all. He's like, well, how should I approach this person? I said, with clarity, with honesty, tell him that you need his help. And he's going to be excited because he wants to be part of your story. In any case, folks, be part of the story. Be part of the Jewish story in the Land of Israel Network. And, of course, the Yishai Fleischer Show. To help support this show, go to yishaifleischer.com. And I saw my friends, the Michel family, were here from Switzerland, who always helped me. And thank you so much for your continued support over the years. And all the good friends out there. But thank you so much for being part of the story. Keep being part of the story. Got into the car today on the way over here. It's been what is the word of our time? The word of our time is it used to be called frazzled or fragmented, or you had to do a defrag. Today they have a different word, frenetic. Frenetic. Is that a correct word?
Frenetic.
That's the jumbled, crazy world that we live in.
Yeah.
Driving out of Efrat, I told you I saw the Temple Mount, but I picked up an 81-year-old Jew named Eliyahu. He proceeded to tell me the story of his life, Moroccan Jew, and he told me about how his first wife died. He married a second wife. A second wife wanted a divorce. He divorced her. Then she called him, and she wanted to get back together, and he said okay. They got back together and they bought apartments, and he told me this whole story, and inside he weaved so many blessings to me to have a new life and all this. I really felt like Eliyahu came and gave me a lot of blessings in the Moroccan Israeli fashion. So there's but still the life is very frenetic, and this Torah portion is a bit frenetic as well, in the sense that two themes that we heard last week are going to come back to us again. And then at the end of this Torah portion, we're going to see some revolutions in this Torah portion.
Yes.
I think we're going to see two big revolutions, let's call it, two huge revolutions. Well, three big revolutions. One revolution is going to be that there's going to be a revolution in the sense that Sodom is going to be flipped.
That's right.
That is a revolution.
Yep.
But before that, there's going to be an argument between man and God. Abraham is going to go to bat for a... The first liberal Jew, by the way, I'm sure of it. Abraham, the first liberal Jew.
Let's call him the first universalist.
Whatever.
There's a difference.
Okay.
We can talk about
time. Oh, fine. Maybe he's the first progressive, whatever you want to call him, okay? But the bottom line, you know what I'm talking about.
I know you're talking
he
about.
He goes to bat for the bad guys, okay? He says, don't put him in jail. Call it rehabilitation. He says.
They are the anti-Abraham.
Right.
But it's not just that he goes to bat. It's a setup.
Let's just clarify, and I'm going to let you get into it. We're talking about we're going to have to go fast through this Torah portion. The first thing is that God is once again going to send angels. He's going to once again tell Abraham that guess what, you're going to have a son. His name is going to be Yitzchak, and this time it's going to be Sarah that laughs. Remember last week Abraham laughed. This time Sarah laughs, but this time
slightly different tone.
Seemingly God says to Abraham, Sarah laughed, saying, and this is so awesome because we hear what Sarah says in her heart. The Torah tells us, I have become old. I've become, my skin has become withered. Will I once again be young? And my master, i.e. Abraham, is old. Says God to Abraham, why did she say that she got old? He didn't tell her.
He left out the other half.
Right, he left out the other half. Gemara says this is a proof that sometimes you can bend the truth for shalom bias.
Listen, people, just remember this. There are three gates that everything that comes in your mouth has to pass through, right? Is it true? Is it necessary? And is it kind? Right? If it doesn't pass those qualifiers, don't say it.
Right. In general, by the way, we need a tikkun for the mouth. We need a tikkun for what goes in and what comes out.
That's true.
That's the big stuff. Any case, that's the first part of the story. Then we're going to learn that God wants to destroy Sodom. Sodom, nearby here, really, really a few clicks away.
I live quite close.
You live quite close to Sodom. And it was one time like a very green place until God flipped it, sent down destruction, the kind of which hadn't been seen since the Mabul, since the deluge.
More local, but quite intensive.
Right. Yeah, very intensive, a big deluge. And Abraham, God tells Abraham, he kind of informs him what's going on.
Well, and that's actually where I wanted to start.
Go ahead.
It's a phenomenal event in the Torah when God turns to the reader and draws you into the narrative. Right? This line, Vashem amar, ha-mechaseni ma'avram, asher ani oseh. Am I going to hide from Avraham that which I'm about to do? And he goes on and explains. But the question is, wait, God, who are you talking to? And the only answer there could be is the reader. And when you're learning, you need to pay close attention. Anytime the Torah turns directly to you as reader and invites you into what's happening, it means you must not miss what is about to come. Because what's about to come is truly revolution, as you said.
Right.
That when Avraham, who, you know, on the surface of it, when God says, I'm going to destroy Sodom, what should Avraham say?
It's your world, boss.
Not only that, but yeah, the you know?
Right.
The koi vecha, right?
Like, fool on them.
Right, they let them all go down like right. that. They are the anti-Avraham. The Midrash makes it very clear that their great sin was that they not only rejected guests, but that they abused them.
They tortured them. And we'll get an actual, we'll get a glimpse into it. The Torah will give us a, you know, we'll zoom right over there, and we'll be privy to what they do. And basically, they are sodomizers. They are rapists.
Yes.
And when they found out that there's guests in the town, little did they know that these guests were laser powered angels.
Right.
Who are gonna smite you. You know what I mean?
But wait, let's not go there yet.
Right.
Because what's the first revolution?
The first revolution is that God says to Abraham, "I'm going to destroy the city," and Abraham gets into a long and detailed discourse, dialogue, shall we say even argument?
Negotiation, argument.
Advocacy.
Advocacy.
And, he basically goes to advocate for these sodomites.
According, I've heard Reb Shlomo say it. Certainly my Rabbi Rav Daniel has told me many times, and I've seen hints of it in the Svarim Kedoshim, as we say, the holy books, that this is the first actual prayer in the entire Torah. Everything up till now, everything that Noach might have done, everything that Adam might have done, when Cain says to God, wow, like, it's really too hard for you to bear my sin, that was something else. It was pleading. It was asking. You know, by the way, you know, how does a dog bark in Israel? What do dogs say?
Hav.
Right, so it's important to know that Israeli dogs don't bark in Hebrew. They bark in Aramaic.
Uh-huh.
Right, because hav in Aramaic means gimme, gimme, gimme.
Right.
So the sages tell us that up until now, all the prayers of the Bible had been like dogs barking, and a lot of us unfortunately pray that way. Hav, 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 gimme, gimme, gimme. Avraham is the first person to step to God and say, no, that the world doesn't need to be like that. Not only that, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. He says, the judge of all the land isn't going to do justice. God, I know you better than that, says Avraham.
You can do better.
You can do better than this. He demands that the world be better than it is, better than God's expressed will.
It's there of the two big revolutions of this, like, interhuman, the I thou, the God human relationship, which we'll learn about in this week's Torah portion. This one is just the what did the Gemara say just the other day in the Daf Yomi? Chutzpah klepei Shmaya Mehanya, that even a certain bit of chutzpah, a certain bit of, well, you know what, if I have to translate chutzpah, then don't listen to the show, okay? No. Okay. Every Gentile in New York City knows what chutzpah is, okay? Yeah, watch Seinfeld, you know what chutzpah is. Anyway, yeah, so a certain, this is the ultimate chutzpah towards God. That's one of the phrases in the Bible which I'm always like, I like do a lump swallow in my throat when Abraham says, shouldn't the judge of all the land do justice, or the judge of the land shall not do justice? Question mark.
Right.
It's like sardonic a little bit. It's like,
and yet all of creation up to this point has been heading for this moment, because otherwise, why make the world? Right. I mean, you could go right back to the biggest question of all: why make the world if you can't?
Well, more fairly, why make right? Well.
No, why make the world? Why make the world at all?
Because you had to make the world, you had to give free choice. Or else you didn't need to make the world. Everybody's following your thing.
It's a red herring, this whole free choice thing. It's a red herring because I don't want to get in too much with it. But you know, you didn't choose your race. You didn't choose your religion.
Angels don't choose.
It's all about relationship. And in a real relationship, there has to be other. And it's true, free choice is an expression of that otherness. But the core issue is that there is other. And you know what? You know who else says to us, Shofet Kol Ha'aretz, Lo Ya'aseh Mishpat, the judge of all the earth shouldn't do justice. You know who else says to us, I know you better than that? The people that we really love. Think about it. Your spouse, your friends, the people that you're close to are the ones who look at you when you're acting a certain way, and they say, no, it's not you. You say, what do you mean it's not me? I'm like, yeah, no, it's absolutely me right now. They're like, no, no, no. It's actually not you. I know you. And that's why God prefaces the whole episode here by saying, I'm going to cover this up. No, he's hinting to the reader, pay attention. I want you to know what life is about. Life is not about a passive obedience. God says, I created the trees. I created the dogs. I created the crickets. I created all that. They're all very nice and sweet and kind and very passive. And then I created humanity. Now, we've seen Sdom, what happens when humanity just takes its active nature and goes astray. Well, that gets destroyed. So God says, I'm not afraid to do that either. But what I really want is someone who will be an active partner with me in creation. And following on the circumcision, Avram's act of completion of himself that we saw last week, this is its expression, because now he is so much himself, he will step to God and say, no, this is not the way we run the world.
All right, so there is a fight here. Let's put it this way. He's demanding of God even more.
Yes,
fine.
Exactly.
And yet we're going to deal with two cases within this Torah portion where that is challenged. I'll explain what I mean. The first is, now Isaac is going to be born in this week's Torah portion. Dun, dun, dun. Woo! That, by the way, is also a revolution.
Yes,
that's also a revolution. The fact that God intervened in this world, made such a miracle happen, Isaac is born. And when Isaac is born, that really is continuity for Abraham.
Absolutely.
And that's what the last week's Torah portion, Lech Lecha, the big question mark, is there continuity for Abraham? And in the end of this week's Torah portion, the answer will be, yes, there is continuity for Abraham.
But not the way you thought.
Well, I'm saying at the very, very end.
Oh, last week's or this week's?
At the end of this week's Torah portion, it's going to be like, and there is a daughter out there to marry Isaac. There is continuity for Abraham. We'll get to that in a second. But before we go to that, Abraham stands up in his let's call it his, he's known as the man of kindness, Ish Chesed. Yet he is going to face a moment where his chesed is, and this is where I'm putting that liberal conservative kind of argumentation. It doesn't fit. It's anachronistic, but still, he at some point after Isaac is born, Sarah recognizes, hey, this Ishmael, it's not good to keep Ishmael around with Isaac. Isaac is the true inheritor, and I have to separate them. Okay, they need some distance from one another. I need Ishmael to leave. And she says, you got to kick out Ishmael and his mom. You got to kick them out of this household. It's just not going to work together well. It needs separation. It's like meat and milk. You know, they both have their place, but it needs separation. I need my son to inherit properly here. And Abraham, coming from that place of kindness, is unable to make that harsh.
That harsh cut.
And God says to him, everything that Sarah told you, Shema Bekola, listen to her voice. And my explanation always is, he doesn't command him to kick Ishmael and Hagar out. He says, your wife actually saw it. You didn't need a godly commandment. You don't need a prophecy. She saw it with her fleshly eyes. By the way, she is a prophetess, but in any case, she saw what's right. And you, sir, you missed it. Missed it, Abraham. You missed it. She saw it with her regular eyes, and that's why I want you to listen to her.
I mean, part of this is also the fact that Abraham will never be able to raise Yitzchak to whom he needs to be if he doesn't listen to his wife. Meaning it's a message for what it is to be a parent, is that it's not about being right. It's about being together.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there's a very important, sort of very simple element of their relationship in this, is that you might think on the surface of it, Abraham is everything and Sarah's his wife. He's also got Hagar. He's also got mistake. That's not the way Yitzchak will come into the world.
Yeah, that's a great point that you're making. And I want to, by the way, talk just for a second, tiny parentheses, tell you that in Hebrew, as in English, you could say fathers, and that includes fathers and mothers. The male form in language can be encompassing of the female as well, right?
Yeah, it is the gender neutral.
Right. And so you can say in Hebrew, Hebron is the city of the forefathers,
right,
or in Hebrew, Ir HaAvot. But I've been saying to people, even though that is true linguistically, it's not enough today. Today we have to say Ir HaAvot VaImot.
No question.
The city of the fathers and the mothers. Hadgish it, like,
yeah, to give it an emphasis and make it clear.
Make it clear, because that the women are very much part of the story.
Even the OU has come around to that perspective.
Yeah. The Abraham's kindness, in a sense, is... what's the word I want to find here? It's like too... It needs to be a little bit reined in a tad.
Well, because his kindness... Abraham is ish chesed. Right, and it's true we translate chesed as kindness or loving kindness, but remember that the core meaning of chesed is it's boundless.
Right,
and therefore there's a very important element where it needs to be bounded, as you said.
Right, it needs to be bounded. And now I'm going to skip over the whole Sodom story, which is one of the more intriguing stories in the Torah.
Fairly well known.
We'll get back to it, I hope, on the show today. And also, it's very graphic.
Oh yeah.
You know what? I'll talk about that in a second. But I want to skip now because we're on one theme here, which is these themes of the revolutions of Abraham's, the Abrahamic revolutions, we could call them, really.
You say you want a revolution.
Right. And the revolution here is, the first one, I think, is the birth of Isaac. The first revolution is Abraham. You know, just the fact that there is an Abraham.
And its expression in that argument with God.
That's it. Right. Exactly. I was going to go
there.
And then
it finds its continuity in the birth of Yitzchak.
Right. And then... Oh, here we go. The big bump of them all. You know, the big challenging kind of story of the Torah is the story of the binding.
So central.
The binding, the Akedah. It's got its own name. Like the story's got its name. It's that word, the Akedah, doesn't say, and now begin the story of the Akedah. That's the name that we give it, because it's such a central story. It's like just a paragraph long, but that story has its own name, the Akedah. Hakidah,
in many ways, it's the centerpiece of the Bible.
Right, right. And it's certainly the pillar of faith for the Jewish people. And basically, the same man that argues for the rights of the wicked members of Sodom, the same man who prayed so much, we learned, and really gave other options for his own continuity, whether it be Eliezer or Ishmael, gets the real continuity through Isaac. And this man is a man who has fought against idolatry throughout his life, including the idolatry especially of child sacrifice. Suddenly gets the commandment, guess what, Abraham? I want you to go sacrifice or offer up your son at the special place, the land of Moriah. Okay, and he gives him the second Lech Lecha. There's a second Lech Lecha in this world. There's two Lech Lechas. The first Lech Lecha is to go into the land and sanctify the land. Now, I want you to go up to within the land. I want you to go up to this holy mountain, right? And go Lech Lecha to the Eretz, to the land of Moriah. There, I want you to offer up your son. And here we have the famous 3 days of silence where Abraham is walking and he's contemplating. And this is also made famous by a non-Jewish scholar, Kierkegaard, who talks about these like 3 days of what's going through Abraham's mind.
Got a whole book on it.
Right.
Fear and Trembling. Very powerful work. Before we get into it, I do want to say it's very important in the context of ever discussing the Akedah that our sages place the Akedah at the beginning of the prayer service in the morning. Meaning any conversation that we have about this, I think, needs to be in the context of returning to it every single day. This is not a story that one gets and they hop. That they just understand it and like, oh, I know what that means. Mm-hmm. It's a story that changes through one's life. Mm-hmm. It's a story that is meant to actually change you through your life. Mm-hmm. It is a fixed point around which so much of our consciousness revolves and returns again and again. Mm-hmm. And in the end of the day, that's what I believe this story is about. Because if the first revolution you named really birthed Avraham into the world as he was meant to be, he finally had that chutzpah, that sense of fullness of self. Mm-hmm. That allowed him to stand up and look at God's explicit command and say, no, that's not the way. Not the way he doesn't say it's not the way it's meant to be. It's not the way that you want to be. The next phase is actually birthing a new face of God into the world. It's a very important process of the Akedah, which has nothing to do with Avraham and Yitzchak. It has everything to do with God. You know, there's a very critical piece that the English reader may miss. And that's why I want to actually bring this out. And then I'll bounce it back to you. Is that when it says, when the text says, it was after these things that God tested Abraham. That word Elohim is a very particular name of God. But in that critical moment, when God stops Abraham, it's a different name of God. Up until then, it's been Elohim. And then in that moment, it's Havaya. It's the four-lettered name of God. And there is a revolution.
So it starts with the judgment-type name, or the laws of nature-type name.
With God as bounded by human existence.
Okay.
Meaning God is speaking to Avram, so there's something coming from outside. But the word Elohim, as you said, means all the powers of the world.
Right.
And one of the greatness of Israelite...
It's also the same. The word can be even used interchangeably with judges.
Right. Which, if you think about it, judges are another power of the world.
Right.
And one of the geniuses of Israelite...
The sovereignty that's granted over to humanity.
Right. Judging life and death.
Right.
And one of the geniuses of Israelite tradition is we recognize that though one can experience the powers of the world as diverse, they have one source. So that's why that name is actually plural, but it's referring to a singular. Mm-hmm. Whereas what happens when Avram is faced with a situation where his experience is overreaching his understanding. His understanding of the world is based in Elohim. He gets the world. God is speaking to him. And then God says, by the way, Yitzhak, he's going to be your future. Now take him up on that mountain. That doesn't work together in the world as he knows it. And yet he moves forward. But that's what Kierkegaard, by the way, calls the absurd, because he was like the existentialist type. It's not absurd. It's Avram's acceptance of the fact that if you live in a world which is always bounded by your understanding, then your God will be an idol. Because you must reduce God to your world. And even if God is speaking to you...
Because you own him through understanding it through your logic.
Because if you don't understand and you reject that as something which is not real, that means you shrink the world to your understanding, and that means shrinking God as well.
Right.
But it also doesn't mean a blindness of then saying, well, whatever God tells me must be true. Avram, the struggle must have been titanic. And in his ability to move forward and to allow his experience to drive him and not his understanding, he bursts a completely new understanding of God into the world.
Well, let's try to drill down on that, but at the same time, without going too deep. What's the simple essential message here? Because a lot of folks, what they find to be very troubling is that, and there are even Jewish. Not in the traditional kind of world, but Jewish thinkers about the Bible who sometimes say, here is his big mistake. Of course, we don't...
Or he failed the test.
Right, failed the test. And he should have said, absolutely not. But I think those people are wrong and also textually wrong because you see that God does not say that. But the question that they level is, where's... your arguments now, Abraham.
Yeah.
Where's your chutzpah?
Where's your sense of morality with which you judge God?
Right. At least where's your throw out a question mark, be like, did I hear you right? Is it right? Did I just get heat stroke? It's the desert out here. I think he said sacrifice your son, but couldn't have meant that.
And it's very important, by the way, that he says
what is the silence?
He says kachna. Right. God says kachna. He says please.
Please, right.
Please take it. It's not a command.
Right.
It's a request. And in many ways, that's what makes it different than when it happens at Sodom.
Right.
Sodom, God gives a command, and Abraham says, no way. We're not going to do it like that. I know you better than that. Here, God is asking Abraham to be something other than he's ever been.
So I want to say two things about that. One thing is, I've mentioned a few times on the show now, is that this past year, I went to Auschwitz for the first time in my life. First time in this version of life, right? I was in Auschwitz with Shmuley Boteach. I don't know why, but I got to tell you that made a big imprint on my mind. And we walked and walked through Birkenau.
It's
my
huge.
Feet were so tired. I was mamash. He totally finished me off physically that day.
Right.
And there was something of an avdut, like a slavery that I felt on that day. And it somehow just fit. I didn't even realize it until afterwards. And I saw for the first time a gas chamber, because there's one that's actually extant. Mm-hmm. The rest were destroyed in various ways, including the famous Jewish revolt at Birkenau. But I saw one of those gas chambers where there's a gas chamber and then there's a crematorium.
Yes.
They're related things. Kill them and then get rid of the evidence.
Yep.
And I heard it. I heard the Akedah. I heard the call of the Jews saying, we're going in and we're going to die. We're going to offer ourselves up on some kind of altar here. But the story will go on. And that we, you know, and Father Abraham almost finished off his progeny. And at the end we were saved, and so too our souls will be saved. And it was just like this thing. Here's what I'm trying to say. There's an element of self-sacrifice as a Jew.
Absolutely. And what it is it's a dedication to life, where my embodied life is a tool of my dedication to life, but it's not the sum total.
Right.
What Yitzchak represents is if you reverse the letters of his name, Keitz Chai, the edges of life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What Yitzchak's, and the image of Yitzchak when you pray, needs to be fire.
Right.
Yitzchak is that fire, that sense that when I look at the world and I see all these specific things, you know what the power of, we're sitting in this room with, you know, with tables and chairs and boxes, you know, every single thing in this room will burn.
Right.
Because there's an energy which they share that transcends their individual form. And Yitzchak is the embodiment of a dedication to life which transcends embodied form. And when Avram was tested, what God was saying to him is, listen, you begged and pleaded to me for continuity because you're dedicated to life. You are Ish Chesed. You are the person of boundless love and commitment. But I want to see, do you really understand what life is? Because if this becomes a worship of yourself and your particular form and your ability to hand on to your children, then you are an idolater. You will stay in that world of Elohim, of the boundedness, and you will never really be able to bring the shame of Vaya into the world. Notice, by the way, when Yitzchak says, hey, Dad, I see the wood, I see the fire.
Where is the sacrifice?
Right, notice he doesn't mention the knife.
Right.
He says, where is the lamb? Avram says, Elohim yireh. Right? God sees. What does he rename?
I always thought it meant God will show him. Yireh lo tasilo el.
He sees for himself. Yireh. Right.
There's a play between show and
it's the whole part. I mean, listen, lifetime's work, and anybody out there wants to join us at Pardes in my class on Mondays and Wednesdays, we're going to get into this in a very big way. It takes a lot of time, but the between seeing and fear is very big. But he basically says God sees, but God in the same of Elohim. What does he rename the place?
Yireh.
Hashem Yireh.
Right.
Avraham
becomes part of the word Yerushalayim.
It becomes what Yerushalayim is. Right. Is that there's a way in which Avraham used to relate to the Havaya, to the sense of God that transcends all boundary, that you have to have a loss of self. Right. Because God is the infinite means that I can't exist.
Right.
And he has a realization that God is the infinite means that I can exist and sees me, and ultimately that I will see God.
Mixed into this whole story is also the birth of the temple, and this at this very spot. Great Talmudic phrase, Lirot Ulehiraot, where you come to the three festivals, you come to see and be seen.
Absolutely.
Both by others and by God, of course.
Rooted in that story of the binding.
Right. And right after the binding, you know, famously, he will not be sacrificed. Oh, and I have to mention here something that Jonathan Sacks said. Jonathan Sacks, you know, not a trivial person at all.
Rabbi Lord Doctor
Jonathan Sacks, great ties. He said in a lot of super smart books, but he said something about the Akedah which I found to be at least a great little chunk that you could chew on. And he says basically he was arguing with some atheist or some famous atheist. And basically they got into the topic of the Akedah, and basically, you know, the guy accused God, the other dude accused God of you know, wanting child sacrifice, and then Jonathan Sacks says, no, the Akedah is exactly the opposite. In those times, every god, if you were a serious god, you wanted a child sacrifice. And then what God said through this act is, I do not want that. I do not want that. Like, this is a story to tell you, no, do not. See, I kind of lured you in, and then I was like, no, I don't want that at all.
In many ways, the greatness of Avraham in that moment was his ability not to do it.
Right. And the Talmud goes on, and it says, can I at least give him a nick? Draw a little blood.
Right.
I'm ready.
And what you're hearing in that is his transformation fully from the roots of idolatry into the true worship of God.
Mm-hmm.
This is his moment of freedom.
Right.
This is the moment in which his consciousness is birthed on the level that we are still sitting here talking about that story now. Because if he had stayed in the world of Elohim, of the God of nature, the God which is bounded by our experience, then we would not be having this conversation now. And the Akedah is the turning point.
So the Akedah, the binding, is really the Abrahamic revolution, the continuing survival, and also, in a sense, the rebirth of Isaac, since the Kabbalistic literature says that he actually gave his soul. The soul left his body, got a kind of pushed back in. Also,
well, Midrash says that Avram slaughtered him and burned his body, and his ashes rest before God forever.
That's right. So there's a kind of a, there's like death and life all mixed in there, but it's definitely, and that's why, as you said earlier, Rabbi Mike Foyer, that it's kind of a study, a life study, a returning text
daily,
daily, and the temple was born. The temple is born without it being said so exactly. The Temple Mount, the temple is born, and that great service for the future is already present there.
Did you see? This is the same thing. I get this from my students here all the time. Speaking of liberals and progressives, is they, why this place? Isn't that idolatrous?
Right.
We have a place, and I say to them, listen. If you're everywhere, you're nowhere. The fact that having a place,
if you've underlined
you,
everything, you've underlined nothing.
Yes, exactly. Right. You go. That's an excellent example.
Yes.
You go through a book and you underline everything that's important to you. You can have the same book. You've learned nothing.
Right.
Right. The power of the temple is that place matters, but not to the exclusion of other, but to the emphasis. Right? God loves one people. Doesn't teach us he loves them to the exclusion of others. Teaches us that he could love at all. Love is intimate. Intimacy is about commitment to you and not someone else. This place is about the fact that we can connect to God in this world at all, and that is absolutely born at the Akedah.
Right, and there's a point. There's a meeting point between heaven and earth.
If there's no meeting point, if there's no specificity,
it's not everywhere.
There's no relationship.
Exactly.
Relationship always happens in the specific.
Okay, so now let's go to the. We just dealt with the Akedah. That's the end of the Torah portion. Let us now. By the way, if I didn't say we're in the Torah portion of Vayera, what chapters is that around?
Well, it ends in 22. It
ends at 22, and beforehand, starts, the book of Genesis, book of Bereshit. And there's a sister story here, also has violence, because you could say that the Akedah is violent or almost violent, and through that is kind of learned out something else, but... And we basically gave birth to the Messianic period in terms of the temples and their placements. There's a sister story here, I think, which is the story of Sodom. And basically, you have here Lot. He went down to live in Sodom and Gomorrah, which were obviously very successful places, very wealthy places, very, very lush places.
Chose the good life.
He chose the good life, but they also had a very chronic... There was a true breakdown of morality there.
It was rotten to the core.
It was rotten to the core.
It was like Rome at the height of its wealth.
You know, it seems to me even more than that. It seems to me that it was corrupt in even a loveless way. It was much more like a kind of, you know, the worst places that you can imagine where power was absolutely corrupted. Listen, where people were not valued. The humanity of individuals are not valued.
I mean, and in that way, you are correct that it is the inverse of the Akedah story. Where it was the debasement of life.
Right.
Is that the individual in Sodom was just an object, as opposed to the individual being a specific point of meeting for the infinite. And so therefore, that's why Sodom is characterized by literally using people as objects.
Right, and but against their will and in a violent fashion.
Yes, that's what I mean by object. There is an object that has no will.
Right.
That's what I mean.
That's right.
If I have a subject-object relationship, I'm the one that matters.
Right.
You're just an object of my desire.
Right. You know, because there's a difference, like Lahavdil, for example, the story of like Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein, right now, which is in the news. I happen to be very interested in that story because I feel like it's also a Jewish story. Did we talk about that last week?
We spoke about it.
Like, and I'm actually heading out to Los Angeles in 2 weeks, and I'm just kind of curious to see where it's at there because, you know, I think that we all know that a place like Hollywood is a place of licentiousness.
And objectification.
And objectification, but it's kind of like. But one thing you could say about it is that, generally speaking, you'd like to think that it's a consensual thing. But when...
Yeah, but objectification is never consensual.
Or
that's
it
my
is.
Point.
Or it is.
No, it's
or
not,
or...
because an object has no will. You got to understand what I'm talking
about. But you might be willing to go into becoming an object. You might be willing to do that.
Okay, we don't have to divide.
But the point is that there's...
There.
But it can... But it goes... But it, you're right. in the sense that it regresses from there.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's what Weinstein is. Weinstein is and by the way, if you've watched some of the Weinstein movies, they're fabulous. Some of the movies that he's
made
are,
I don't know what he made.
You know, some of my favorite movies. That's what bothers me also, because I don't have so many favorite movies, and the ones that are happen to be under this production house. For example, Lady in Gold, which is about I've done many interviews on this movie, about art restitution, the famous Klimt restitution from the Austrians. Great movie. And also another one of my personal favorite movies, which is The King's Speech. Mm. Okay, it's great stuff, and you see the genius, the creative genius, and how it devolves, how absolute power kind of becomes corrupted, and money and all that, and it just becomes like, and then when you hear these stories about what was going on, you're like, this isn't even human.
He was a predator.
Yes, he was a predator, but I think that there's, when you say that, here's me being liberal to this guy, I think there's also... I think there's a sickness, a lot, but I think he was a predator on, I think he was being, I think he had succumbed to the most, you know, it became like, when you listen to stories, you're like, this man lost all sense of Tzelem Elohim.
Listen, there's a deep question in the link between the creative and that desire. And also, by the way, the pain that you feel around, like, do I watch his movies anymore? Do I like it? I mean, this is not necessarily the time or place to discuss it, but there are many people whose contributions to thought, art, experience have been rich and powerful. And when you scrape even the surface off their personal life, you say, oh.
My father, for example, would never bought German products, never listened to Wagner. And he was also very sensitive. He would be like, that's them. He would be able to point out that's their influence. He was very good at that. You know, I could listen to Bach or Beethoven, not sense any kind of German influence, but he was very sensitive to their influence. Anyway, that is an interesting question about art that we're talking about. Any case, let's get back just a second to Sodom.
so
basically Sodom is this place where, like, you know, these like, and it's speaking of Hollywood, here's a real Hollywood version of things, you know.
Oh,
two angels come down there, you know, and they're like, okay, we're gonna
clean this place out.
Yeah, we're flipping.
Grab the
this.
Wife and kids, get out of town, though.
Right. Oh, you know, I had another visual thought about that. You know, there is a visual image of Mrs. Loat, right? And Mrs. Loat, she's being whisked out of town. Everything about Loat, he doesn't want to get pulled out of this thing. He's Vit Mameh, right? He is delaying. What that word I said?
We really have to go.
What
there's
is this thing
town.
Called again? What is this?
I forget what that.
There's a cantillation mark which makes you say it in a very long way, and he gets like he's pulled in. They say, "Don't look back now. Don't look back." And Mrs. Loat, she looks back, becomes a pillar of salt.
Yeah.
Because she looked back at Nordstrom, and she was like, Nordstrom, Super Target, no! Okay. To me, right, you go downtown to Manhattan, and you see that golden Merrill Lynch bull, and the quintessential opposite of that is Mrs. Potiphar's salt pillar, right? The quintessential opposite, like, visual thing that's supposed to represent to you, don't go there, man. Don't go there. Why did she become a pillar of salt? So that you know that there's this thing. That's what should be downtown in Manhattan, a big pillar of salt representation, and they'd keep you on the straight and narrow.
I mean, it's a very powerful reminder that God's grace does exist in the world, right? That God does pull us out of these situations of snum. But if you get that grace, the most important thing to do is don't look back. Don't regret. It may have been great. It may have been a lot of fun. But live your life looking forward.
And don't get pulled back in. Don't get pulled back into that thing.
Well, yeah, it's the danger.
Yeah. Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in, right? That's from The Godfather.
Yeah. it sounded familiar.
Anyway, Mrs. Loat goes down. Sodom goes down, gets flipped. We hear echoes of that in the story of Jonah. 40 days from now, this town is going to be flipped. You know, people are like, oh, my God, they mean business.
We know that phrase.
Right, we know that phrase. And this
fire and brimstone.
Right, it becomes, right, it literally becomes a fire and brimstone.
Well,
gets
this
totally
is the phrase,
destroyed.
Tumstrum.
Right, exactly. But the last part of the story is that Loat is saved with his two daughters. His two daughters are the ones that make it alive. And guess what they think? They think the world's been destroyed. They think the world's been destroyed, and now it's their job to repopulate the world. And they're in a cave. And guess what? There's a bottle of wine there. Look at that.
A number of them, apparently.
Look at that. Would you?
What a coincidence.
Can you believe that? There's a bottle of wine in here. Well, that's going to be good, because what we're going to do is we're going to ply. And isn't English great that it has a word like that, ply? I don't think there's a word like that, you know, in Hebrew that's specifically to get somebody drunk. We're going to ply our father with wine. We're going to have relations with him and thereby repopulate the world. Thereby, they do create, and that indeed does happen, they create two nations, Ammon and Moab, who are going to be the enemies of the Jewish people. So you know, the Lot and his offspring in the end, being end up, though protected by God, kind of at the time of the Jewish peoples are conquering the land of Israel, the distance between Abraham and Lot is so far that his ancestry of Lot becomes the enemies of the Jewish people. And yet, within that, there's going to be a Moabite princess who's going to make her way back following a poor, broken old lady named Naomi, and she's going to come back to Bethlehem. She's going to convert and marry into the Judean dynasty, the dynasty of Judah, the tribe of Judah, and through that is going to be birthed the seed of King David and later on Messiah. Mashiach. So in this dark Sodom, flipped upside down in a dark cave with incest, is going to be born the enemies of the Jewish people, and so too the Messiah of the world.
I mean, this is one of the great mysteries of the narrative of the Torah, and also, of course, one of the great mysteries of the narrative of Mashiach, of Messiah in the world. Two things. I'm not going to solve the problem, but there's two things to always remember when you're looking for redemption. And they both come from this story. First of all, choose life. That whatever we may say about the ugliness of the story of Lot and his daughters, it's driven, as you said, by that fear that life should not continue. And that drive to choose life is a core drive of who we are as a people in the world. The other one is that the secret of Mashiach is that God doesn't need us for the angelic and perfect side of creation. God can have that, so to speak, without us. What we have to offer is actually the messy, broken, dirty side of the human experience, because we can uplift it and offer it to God. And so that's the core message, I think, that comes out of this Mashiach, is that that choosing life is what allows us to take that gross, dark, ugly side of life and lift it up, and through that to bring redemption.
I just feel like there's a Los Angeles or Hollywood Jew that's going to be disgusted by what's happening in Los Angeles and say to himself, you know, I don't want my kid to grow up in Sodom and Gomorrah. I don't want him to be this, and he's going to make Aliyah, and that kid's going to cure cancer, his son, you know, or daughter.
Or bring Mashiach.
Right, or bring Mashiach, whatever it is. I just mean to say in that, like there can be an aha moment here. And also at the same time, there's something that is beyond aha. There's a lot beyond aha. And one of the things that really the Kabbalists say is that the seed of Mashiach is so precious, and so much is the hunger for the dark side to destroy it, for Darth Vader to get this, you know, Luke Skywalker of Mashiach, that it needs to be hidden away. It needs to be hidden away in the dark places where the dark forces are like, it's definitely not here.
We wouldn't look there.
Yeah, we want to look there. You know, where's Mashiach? Where's Waldo?
It's not going to be Darth Vader that kills the Emperor. It'll be Luke.
Very good, friends. All right, folks. There is so much in these Torah portions, but really we talked about big revolutions and the birth of the temple and Messiah are hidden in this Torah portion. Rabbi Mike Foyer, I want to thank you again for taking time to meet with me here at Pardes Institute. I appreciate it so much. Thank you so much for being part of the Yishai Fleischer Show.
Always a pleasure. A lot has come up here. People should send us an email if they have some thoughts or questions.
That is a good point. An email would be nice, and I think I've been a bit recalcitrant at reading your emails out loud. I will prepare that. I have been moving for the past, like, year, but certainly for the past few months.
Don't slow down.
So things are slowly starting to
settle? Yeah. Don't say it.
Well, settle for more, right? My life was a Sodom and Gomorrah, not in the sodomizing sense, but in the
overturning
sense. And by the way, the Talmud, I once thought to myself, isn't it funny that licentiousness bred also a type of giant spa that was good for the body. And I found that the Talmud says exactly that. The Talmud says exactly those things that led to the kind of destruction of the body and were you know, out of control, led to a place where you go to actually heal the body. So that's today's Dead Sea. It's, and by the way, the land of Israel does not have the highest place in the world, but it certainly has the lowest. It teaches you about the holiness of the land of Israel.
And how deep we really are.
There you go. All right, so Rabbi Mike Foer, your email is RavMike@thelandofIsraelNetwork.com. Also your Facebook page, facebook.com/RavMike. Mine is facebook.com/YishaiFleischer, Yishai@thelandofIsraelNetwork.com. Send me an email. If you were able, I want you to send me an email that says, I listened all the way to the end of the show.
That's and understood half of what you were talking
right.
about.
Right. I want you to put in the subject line, listen to the end. That's all I'm asking for here. Listen to the end, okay?
Small e.
That's right. Right, not the big end. God bless you folks wherever you are. Thank you so much. Thanks to Ben Bresky for editing the show. Thank you so much to Tabitha for taking care of everything. Thank you to my producer, Moshe Herman, who makes a lot of it happen and getting it out to my networks. A lot of folks out there are really part of the story. Thank you so much. Folks, we got to ramp it up and take it to even the next level. Whatever we're doing, we need to be broadcasting even more. We need to be reaching out to one another even more. We need to be talking about it even louder. We need to be talking about it even prouder. That's what we have to do right now. The dark forces want to out-broadcast us. We cannot let them. We've got to let the narrative and the Jewish story and the roar of Zion be heard around the world, the Lion of Zion.
Rah!
That's right. God bless you folks wherever you are. Stay tuned, stay strong. Shalom and Shabbat Shalom.